Thanks, Andrew, and good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, on our last class, we saw David come to the throne over all Israel by what was a truly remarkable set of providential circumstances. And he was crowned king in Hebron. And the record tells us that when the people gathered there, they acknowledged him first, though they probably didn't really understand the full significance of this. They acknowledged him first as a shepherd and secondly as their captain. And while the nations, no doubt, around had seen that a king was to be first captain, as far as God was concerned, a king was first to be shepherd and then a captain. And we saw the wonderful spirit of this man whose influence had spread right throughout that nation, and in a very short time the effects of what was a shocking civil war were almost completely nullified. You know, this man is like few others in Scripture. Anyway, I'm really struggling to find another character in the Old Testament who had such a profound impact on the lives of so many people in such a short time. And after all, I suppose we do expect that, because he was, after all, the man after God's own heart. And being a man after God's own heart did not mean, brothers and sisters, that he was perfect in everything. We know that there are a number of things in David's life that he himself regretted, seriously regretted. And I'm not just talking about the sin with Bathsheba, I'm talking about other things that happened in his life as well. But he was still, nevertheless, after all of those things, still called the man after God's own heart, because he had a spirit that God was drawn to. It was the spirit of God himself that he saw in this man, and others saw it in him as well. And so the people, after that, such a short time after the nation had been plunged into civil war with all the turmoil and intrigue and difficulties that brought, the nation comes, we're told in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, they came with one heart, ready to commit, ready to follow, ready to give their lives to this man. And there was joy, the record tells us. There was joy in Israel for the first time for 20 years. Because the last time the word joy was ever used in Israel was when David himself went out to battle and killed 10,000s, while Saul only killed his thousands. And the people came back absolutely on top of the world with joy. But we find, I'd like you to just turn back a page to 2 Samuel chapter 5. We're going to have a look at verse 6 there, start at this point, because this is the lead-in to this incident that we're going to consider tonight from 2 Samuel 6. And I might say that we're not going to actually stay in 2 Samuel 6. We're going to go to Chronicles record once we get to that bit. And I've done that deliberately so that we've actually now read 2 Samuel 6, and then we're going to work from the Chronicles record, particularly looking at this incident, because it's a little fuller. Okay, well, in verse 6 2 Samuel chapter 5, we find, and the king, this is just after he's been crowned, the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, and spake unto David, saying, except thou take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in hither, thinking that David cannot come in hither. They actually just thought that Jebus, as it was at that stage, was so impregnable that they could have put the blind and the lame to guard it, and David would never have been able to get in. Well, we know that such was not the case. The Chronicles record tells us that David and all Israel went to Jebus. Now, clearly it wasn't all Israel. This really, it says in this record, verse 6, the king and all his men, it was clearly a significant part of those who had come over from the northern kingdoms, northern tribes, as well as his own substantial-sized army, as it was, that went up to Jerusalem to take it. And we find that the inhabitants of the land, we're told in verse 6, went to Jerusalem under the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. You know, that's a... I mean, you could have taken that little phrase out and you wouldn't have noticed it if it hadn't have been there. But how significant is that, really? They went up to the Jebusites, which were the inhabitants of the land. They should never have been the inhabitants of the land. They should never have been there. And the fact that after so many years, after hundreds of years, the Israelites had still never been able to take that city is just quite remarkable. Jebus had a quite interesting history. Joshua actually defeated the Jebusites and killed the king of Jerusalem back in Joshua chapter 10. And then he left it to the inhabitants around that were going to take that region, and that says in Joshua 15 that Judah couldn't drive out the Jebusites, even though Joshua had made a significant inroad into that already. Then we come right through to the time of the judges, and Judah attacks Jerusalem and burns it with fire. They actually had some success at that point, very, very briefly, but in the same chapter, the Benjamites, in whose territory Jebus actually was, it was sort of almost on the border between the territory of Benjamin and Judah, but in Benjamin's territory, the Benjaminites could not drive out the Jebusites, and that's the way it had stayed. So we've got a period there of, 450 years of the judges, and through Saul's reign after that. So we're talking about something not nearly 500 years. It's been in the hands of the Jebusites, and it's still in the possession. So the record here just says, they went up to the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who should never, never have been there. And yet, right in the middle of the land, in this critical little centre, right in the highlands of the Judean hills there, we've got the Canaanites, Jebusites as they were, that are mocking Israel by their presence, by their continued presence. You know, that didn't happen in very many other places. Of course, there were little pockets of it around the land. But here in this critical stronghold, we find that they're still there. And Jebus, as you probably know, means trodden down, or some will say it's a threshing floor, but that's the same idea, where they used to tread down the corn to extract it, and it would just be blown away. So it's really very interesting when we consider Luke chapter 21. It's not going to turn to that now. But the city itself was, as I said a minute ago, on the border of Judah and Benjamin's territory, but had been given to Benjamin. And what we find is that David goes up to take this. Now, the immediate question I think we need to ask here is why did he go and take Jerusalem anyway? What was it? Was it that he suddenly discovered that this city had actually not been taken after 500 years? Did not David know prior to this? Why had he not moved as soon as he'd come back up, as soon as Saul was dead? Why hadn't he gone and actually taken Jerusalem? It would have been a much better place in which to establish his capital. And why just right now? Why Jerusalem and why now? Two questions, brethren, that I think are actually really interesting to answer. Strategically, it wasn't in an important position in the nation, in the land. As we know, if you know anything about the geography of the land of Israel, it's actually up in the high country, on a slope. Jerusalem was built on a slope, and it in times past had walls built which made it very difficult to attack, and that's what the Jebusites actually said. They trusted in that. But I suppose as far as David was concerned, just from a strategic point of view, to go up and occupy this town and make it the capital city was probably not a bad move, because it was neutral. That is, he's just come out of a period of civil war. The nation is now unified. And if he went and took a particular city in any of the territory of Israel, others could have said, you're favouring them and whatever else. So here was a city where he could go and take. It was occupied in actual fact and hadn't been for 500 years by any other tribe, and it was on the border between Benjamin and Judah, the two rival tribes before they'd been united. So I suppose from even a political and strategic point of view, it looked as though it was a good reason. But there's got to be much more than that, much, much more. And we know there was more than that. This was, brothers and sisters, as far as David was concerned, a well-planned, well-thought-out execution. This is not something he dreamed up the night before. And neither is this incident in 2 Samuel 5, when he goes and takes Jebus, just another of the adventures out to quell the nations that were in the land at the time. And we know that David moved out a little later than this, and he had a number of campaigns to expand the borders of the nation. This is not just a capricious thing of the army. This is something that David had planned for a very long time, and we actually know that factually from the scriptures. Not only that, brothers and sisters, I think you'll find that this issue of Jebus and Jerusalem cuts at the very core issue to David in his life. That's how important this really was to him. And I think the trigger for him to go to Jerusalem and actually take it was that finally the nation had been welded together as one. And I actually believe that David was waiting for that to happen. He didn't know how it was going to happen, and it certainly didn't look a few years before that it would ever happen because of the way things were actually panning out. But God had brought those events very quickly together, and now he knew that the time was now that he was going to go and take Jebus, and he moved. And I think there's a number of reasons as to why. And we're going to have a look at a couple of passages in a second. Well, let's go to one. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 17. Now, you all know this very well. We're not going to spend much time here. Just look at one verse in 1 Samuel 17. And we know 1 Samuel 17 is the chapter about David and Goliath. And right at the end, we read in verse 54, "And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his arm in his tent." You know, David is probably only about 17 or 18 at the time when he killed Goliath. And I ask you, it wasn't even called Jerusalem at that time. Why on earth did David take the head of Goliath to Jerusalem? To Jebus. And it had been already at that stage for 400 plus years in the hands of the Jebusites, and it still was at the time. And he takes the head up to the city, to a city that is actually still occupied by the Gentiles. What on earth is going on here? What was going on in his head? We know David, at 17 or 18, had an utterly amazing understanding of what he was doing, and not only that, of the purpose of God. And we know that because later he penned Psalm 8. Now, we're not going to go into that now, but Psalm 8 is just an amazing exposition of the conquest of Christ over sin, in effect, seen in his defeat of Goliath. So here's a man, here's a young man, almost just a young boy, that has seen that there's real significance in that city. He had clearly had Jerusalem in his thoughts from a very young age. Well, I think, come back to Deuteronomy chapter 12, because he had clearly read this as well. But this doesn't help us completely. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, you'll be familiar with Deuteronomy chapter 12, because it starts off, "These are the statutes and judgments which you will observe when you come into the land." It was Moses' instructions to them, right? And they were to do all kinds of things. But come to verse 5. But, he says, "Under the place which Yahweh your God shall choose out of all the tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall he seek, and thither shall he come. And thither you shall bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices and tithes," and so on, so on, so on. So it being told that it was going to be a place that God was going to choose. Because up until then, the tabernacle had moved around wherever they were going. But once they got on the land, it was going to be in one place. And verse 11 says the same, and 14 and 18 and 22. And so it goes on for about the next 6 or 7 chapters. And if you've never coloured that in, I think it's a very worthwhile thing to do. "The place which Yahweh your God shall choose." its dominant theme here through these chapters of Deuteronomy. There was a place. There was a place, and David knew there was. There was a place where God had chosen to put his name, and David knew that God had chosen it. Now, it never says in Deuteronomy where that place is. But notice what it did say. We just read in verse 5 that it was this place that even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and thither shall we come. And I think in David's mind, he read that really very carefully, and he thought, wherever that place is, if that's the habitation of God, that is where I am going to be. And I think he had determined in his mind that he was going to actually find out that habitation. And if God was not already there, he was going to try and facilitate it if he could possibly do that. I think he actually worked out where that habitation was. Well, come across to Psalm 132. I just want to have a look at a couple of verses here, and we're going to return just before we finish in Psalm 132 again, because interestingly, Psalm 132 was written around the time of the ark coming to Zion. But let's just look at a couple of things in here in Psalm 132. Let's have a look at verse 13. It says, "For Yahweh hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation." Do you know that was utterly new information in that psalm? This is around the time that we're talking about when David is going up to Jebus, and he actually brought the ark up to Zion. And it says, "Yahweh has chosen Zion." You know, one thing, brothers and sisters, I think is really interesting. When you're reading the Psalms of David, particularly the early Psalms of David, there are numerous references to the hill of God and to the city of God and his habitation and whatever. And no one in the nation knew that that was going to be Jerusalem. Unless they'd worked it out the same way that David had actually worked it out. There are numerous references to Jerusalem. And that we think, oh yes, we know where Jerusalem is. But Jerusalem was at that time in the hands of the Jebusites, and it had been for hundreds of years. So look at verse 14. "This is my rest, says God, forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it." Oh, that is actually what David wanted to find out. And David wrote this psalm, actually. I believe he wrote it. And here he's actually recording this. And as I said, we'll return shortly to this. But verse 17 says, "And there will I make the horn of David to bud." So God was actually going to make David to prosper in this place. All right, let's just go back a minute. Because the focus of David in this psalm is not about making it his capital. It's actually about something else. Let's have a look at verse 4. He says, "I will not give sleep to mine eyes nor slumber to mine eyelids until I find out a place for Yahweh and habitation." You remember where that word appeared in Deuteronomy chapter 12? "And habitation for the mighty God of Jacob." He was not going to let himself have sleep until he found out a habitation for the mighty God of Jacob. But verse 6, I think, is really interesting. He says, "Lo, we heard of it at Ephratah." Let me ask you a question. What did he hear at Ephratah? We heard of it. What's it? Read the next phrase and we'll tell you. What do they find in the field of the woods? In fact, it shouldn't be the field of the woods. They should have actually made it a place name. They just translated it instead of made it a name. "We found it at Kirjath Jearim." Because the field of the woods just meant is Kirjath Jearim translated. What did they find there? Well, they found the ark, didn't they? And look what verse 8 says. "Arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest, thou and the ark of thy strength." You know, this psalm is actually centered around the ark, and it was the ark that was David's focus, because he knew that that represented the presence of God, and where that ark came to rest was where God was going to abide, and wherever God was going to find his habitation, David wanted to be there. David was determined to be there. And you know what? David knew that God had already picked a place, so he scanned the scriptures trying to find out where it was. And you know what? He actually worked it out. But before we actually have a look at that, you look at that first phrase in verse 6. Lo, we heard of it at Ephratah. What's Ephratah? That's another name for Ephratah. Bethlehem. How long since David had been in Bethlehem? At least. Probably more like 28 or so years since David had been in Bethlehem. David left Bethlehem to go into Saul's court. And he never went back, as far as we know. Because he went out and was in the army, and then he was chased into the wilderness, and he never returned. We heard of it at Ephratah. In other words, when David was a child, he knew about something at Kirjath-Jearim, and he thought about it greatly. He knew about that, and he knew that that was going to come to rest somewhere. It wasn't going to just stay in someone's house. And he must have determined when Samuel came and anointed him to be king, that if I've got any power at all, I'm going to find out where that's going to have to go, and I'm going to take it there so that God is at the place that he wants to be. And there he would make his capital. You know, brothers and sisters, that is the reason why he went and took Jebus. It wasn't that he was just sick of the Jebusites in the land. He went and took that city because he'd worked out that that is where God was going to put his name. That's where God was wanting to dwell. And he worked it out because he was thinking about it when he was a 15, 16-year-old, when he first heard about it. And no doubt didn't stop thinking about it all that time. Well, how did he work it out? Well, he must have worked that out from Genesis 14. What happened in Genesis 14? Melchizedek came out. He was king of Jerusalem. He was king of Salem. He was the priest of the Most High God. He was a high priest and a king. And he came out and he blessed Abraham and gave him bread and wine. He was, in fact, the great type of Christ to come, the great Melchizedek priest that was to come in reality was Christ. And here, representing righteousness and being a king, reigning, those qualities were brought together. And David must have thought about that. Here is the progenitor of the nation that's actually being blessed. Melchizedek was greater than Abraham. The record actually tells us so, and Paul tells us in Hebrews. But then only moving on a little further, in Genesis 22, when Abraham is told to go and offer Isaac, he's told to go to the mountains of Moriah. Now that's right at the top of where Jebus was. It's right on the rise of the hill, just above the ancient city of Jebus. And there we know that the angel called out, and Abraham called the place when Isaac was resurrected, so to speak. Abraham called the place Yahweh Yireh, because it says, in the mount of Yahweh it shall be seen. Yahweh will provide, is what Yireh means. And in that place, Yahweh was going to do something. You know, we know later, from 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1, that is the exact site where the Temple of Solomon was built. And David was told that exactly a little later, and we'll get to that probably next year. But this place, Jerusalem, Jebus, Salem, whatever it was called, by all those names, had been associated with sacrifice, with fellowship in patriarchal times. And David had worked out that this was the place where God would put his name. And he moved to capture it, to make it his capital. And you know what happened? Look at, come back to Samuel, 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 5, and what do we find? Verse 10. They took the city. You know the story. Job got up the gutter, got in, and the people were utterly staggered by that. You know, they never thought it could happen. And David went on, or verse 9, David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. David built around from Millo and inward. And David went on and grew great, and Yahweh Elohim of hosts was with him. So there was the first providential stamp in this quest for David to bring God into the place that he desired. So as soon as David had actually taken this city, this stronghold, we find that God blesses him greatly. And David was not unaware of those circumstances. He was always trying to read the providential circumstances in his life. Well, there's a model of Jebus, as it was roughly in the time of David. You can see Mount Moriah up the top here, just up a little higher. Jebus was actually built down on the slope, and if you have a look at there's a picture, you can actually see the pink area, red area here. There's Temple Mount today. You can see the square up here, Temple Mount, and this is the city of David, or Jebus as it was, that he actually took. And this part of the city over here wasn't here. It was the valley coming down here, another valley going up the middle, which has actually since been filled in largely with building over many years, and the Valley of Hinnom, course, going around the other side there. And there it is with a picture today. You can actually see the city of David, the city of Jebus, inside the red area there. And that's the model at the Holy Land Hotel in Jerusalem, where you can actually just see this area up here is the city of David. This narrow little section there, and we find that they took it, we're told, by Joab getting up the gutter, well, out to one side of the city. If we just go back a bit here, you can see where the Gihon Springs are here, coming around about here, towards the back end, I suppose, the higher end of the city. If I just go forward to here, you can see a cut-through picture of that, where the spring was in here. And a channel came through here. There was a tunnel going up here, which is called the gutter here, Joab's gutter, which eventually goes up into this vaulted chamber at the top. And people would come down that slope, drop a bucket or something down the edge, down into that hole, down into the water below, and bring up water. And Joab climbed up that and got into the city. But we're told that in verse 9 that we just read a moment ago, that David dwelt in this fort and called it the City of David, and he built round about from Millo and inward. And I actually think that Millo is this area here. This is a drawing by Brother Lane Rittmeyer of David's palace, and which was built at the top end of the city, and this fill here, which is like a retaining wall, is the Millo, and just really does mean that. And there's even evidence of it that they've uncovered structurally today. That's actually part of the structure that's still in existence in Jerusalem right now, that has been uncovered over the last 20 years or so. So what we're then told straight after this is in verse 11 that Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David, and no doubt wanting to be his friend. And David accepted that friendly overture, and that friendship lasted for some time. And Hiram was keen to pay tribute to David, and he did so in materials and workmanship. And so he became his builder, and they built David a house. But verse 12 is quite staggering. It says, "And David perceived that Yahweh had established him king over Israel, and that he exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake." You know, it almost never happens in human history. Whenever men rise in popularity or in power, or they have significant success or fame, they nearly always take the credit to themselves. And this is saying David took none. It says that David, at that moment, when he's becoming internationally known, that he perceived that the only reason any of this is happening is because God had exalted his kingdom for his people's sake. It had nothing to do with him. And there's a mark of a very great man. In the midst of great prosperity and success, he's marked out as not claiming any of it. You know, it's a very great lesson, isn't it? It's the mark of a man after God's own heart. That this has only happened. So when the successes, brethren and sisters, in our lives, do we actually realise that God's behind it? Or is it our good management or our hard work or whatever else we might like to think? Or have we come to realise, as David had, that it was because of God's purpose with his people that this had happened? Now, our lives are not just, brothers and sisters, ours to pursue, and David felt exactly like that. He was not just going to extend his kingdom and become great for the sake of making David great. He did not just seek ease and glory, but God, and he acknowledged that God was behind all of it. And David was blessed with more children, so we read in the next few verses. And then, out of nowhere, comes a sudden attack. Verse 17, but the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel. All the Philistines came up to seek David, and David heard of it and went down to the hold. This was an extremely serious threat. It's not very clear whether, in fact, this happened before David had actually taken Jebus or after. It may have actually been before he had taken Jerusalem. Whatever happens, I think that it's fairly clear from 1 Chronicles 11 that this hold that he went to, some people have suggested it might have actually been Jerusalem, that is the city of David, it's called the hold, because it is actually called that. It's like a stronghold, that's the idea of it, and it is actually called the stronghold. But 1 Chronicles 11 tells us that at the time when he was being attacked by the Philistines, he actually went down to the cave of Adullam, the hold of Adullam. And then he went up to fight against the Philistines. Now, it would never have said that he went up to fight against the Philistines if he was already in Jerusalem, because from Jerusalem everything was down, both spiritually and physically. So I think that he was actually in the hold of Adullam at the time. He went down to the hold of Adullam. Let's just, we haven't got time to turn this up now, but just make a note of Psalm 57, verses 1 and 2, and read it some stage later. Because, you know, when it says he went down to the hold, I think it's really interesting to know why David went down there. And the hold was a very special place. It wasn't actually that safe, you know. The cave of Adullam was not really that safe. No cave is very safe if you've got armies after you. But to David, the cave of Adullam was the place where he felt he just had to put his trust in God. And it became the symbol to him of absolute dependence on God. So he went down there to prepare himself. This was God's battle, and God was going to be fighting here. Then the Philistines came up into the valley of Rephaim, which is very close to Jerusalem. And David inquires of Yahweh, and Yahweh says, yes, doubtless, go up, I'll deal with them. And he did. David moved in verse 20, and he broke them in pieces. And in fact, he called the name of the place Baal Perazim, the place of breaches. And it was as if there was a river overflowed and it broke up all of the Philistines, and they raced off in all sorts of directions as the flood of David moved in, miraculously moved in. Whether there was, I think it's almost certainly an incredibly miraculous battle, because in Isaiah 28 verse 21, again, we haven't got time to turn to it, but it's worth writing it down in your margin. Isaiah 28, 21, this battle here that David fought with the Philistines becomes a prototype of future battles that they look back at as the amazing victory of David. There was this strange and miraculous work, it says in that verse in Isaiah chapter 28. But David meets them again. The Philistines come back for another dose, and David didn't presume that God would just be with him again. He goes to God again, and the circumstances are different this time, and he's to do something different, and that's in fact what David follows exactly. And so we find that in 1 Chronicles 14, verse 7, after his rout of the Philistines for the second time, he drove them right back to Gaza. It says, David's fame went into all lands, and Yahweh brought the fear of him on all nations. You know, these two battles combined had the effect on the then-known world, like the crossing of the Red Sea did, and like the victory that Israel had over Sihon and Og. It just spread like wildfire, and the nations just were absolutely mesmerized, and fame was brought to David and his kingdom just overnight as a result. And now we move to chapter 6, and it says, "And again David gathered together all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. Well, this again is a bit of a strange word at the front of this verse, because what does he mean, again? Well, I think the Philistine wars here have actually interrupted something, and David now gets back to his original focus. You remember, him taking Jerusalem was actually part of a big plan, and now he's going to move back to that. His focus really was the presence of God. He was not interested in just becoming a great and mighty international star on the political scene. He wasn't interested in that. He was interested more than anything else, not with being king, but being second in the nation. And he wanted God to be king. And he wanted to bring God into the middle of that nation so that they could appreciate that as well. And that's really what this whole next incident is all about. David's attempt to do that, to bring God back into the midst of the nation. Okay, we're going to go to Chronicles now, and we'll stay there for most of the rest of the time. And 1 Chronicles 13 is the parallel record. And when we go to Chronicles, you're going to find that, really because of the purpose for which Chronicles was written, we've got, in fact, four chapters devoted to this whole period, whereas there's only one back in 2 Samuel. So in 1 Chronicles 13, verse 1, we actually have some information that we don't have back in Samuel. And there we read in verse 1 that David consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and every leader. And David said unto all the congregation of Israel, "If it seem good unto you, that it be of Yahweh our God, let us send abroad unto our brethren everywhere that are left in all the land of Israel, and with them also to the priests and the Levites, which are in their cities and suburbs, that they may gather themselves to us, and let us bring again the ark of our God to us. For we inquired not at it in the days of Saul." And all the congregation said that they would do so, for the thing was right in their eyes. So David set about to do it with the help of all those people. It was an amazing move, really. David could have actually done a lot of things on his own here, but he actually gained the groundswell of the people who themselves wanted this to happen. And that must have been encouraging to him. So David gathered all Israel together from Sihor of Egypt, which is even unto the entering of Hamath. Now, from Sihor is right over, possibly at the Nile. That's how far he went. To Hamath, which is way up north in modern Lebanon, almost to the border of modern-day Turkey. It's an amazing distance across there. Now, they weren't actually in control of all of that land completely with no breaks, and yet that's where he gathered the people from. This was to be something very special. In fact, they never, ever again did anything quite like this. And you can see just from the extent of his consultation, of his involvement with the people, gathering them from so far, that this was going to be, in David's mind, a colossal event that he wanted to do. You know, brothers and sisters, David could have actually just gone and got four men, sent them over to Kirjath-Jearim, and said, "Bring the ark." And it could have been done overnight, or in a couple of hours one day, and it was all over. And yet he went to this enormous preparation involving all these people. Remember, 2 Samuel 6 says that just gathering all the captains and the army together, he had 30,000 people there at that stage. Quite amazing, isn't it? But look at what, in verse 3, what it says. He said, "Let us bring again the ark of our God to us." This word "bring again," brothers and sisters, is actually really significant because it's often used in the sense of reformation, that is of people turning around. And sure, they were bringing again the ark back. Yes, that's true. They were literally going to bring the ark back into Jerusalem. But there was something else that was going on that David was more interested in, and it was the turning of the hearts of the people. They were being brought back as well. They wanted to actually have the ark come into there. Here's this groundswell of enthusiasm that is remarkable after such a long period. All through the days of Saul, no one even thought about going getting the ark. No one even bothered to even ask about it. Isn't that amazing? Through all that period. And as soon as David has got all Israel together, the very first thing he wants to do is to bring the ark, the presence of God, back into the nation. And so there's this incredible groundswell, and it goes out to all these people, including Levites and priests and so on. And it just highlights the enormity in David's mind about what this was about. And we know from everything he wrote afterwards as well as what's written in the record here, that it was a momentous thing for David. Because he saw that the ark represented the presence of God in the nation. And he wanted the whole of that nation to see the importance and to experience the joy of having God right alongside them. Because he knew what it was like to be chased around the wilderness, to feel as though at times he was driven away from God. He knew what that was like. And he wanted the nation to understand that they were going to bring God close. You know, they hadn't inquired since the days of Saul. I think we'll skip over that. We won't spend any time there. There's just a little chart on this history of the ark. If anyone wants a copy of that, they can have it afterwards. But you can see that the ark had actually stayed for quite a long time in Shiloh, and then it gets taken out to battle by Hophni and Phinehas, lost to the Philistines, and the Philistines are sick of it after 7 months because it's causing so much damage. And they send it on a cart back to back to Israel. It comes back to Beth Shemesh, which was a city of the Levites and the priests, and they have a catastrophe there, and eventually lands in the house of Abinadab in Kirjath-Jearim. Now, the record, perhaps we won't turn to it now, but in 1 Samuel 7, verse 1 and 2, it actually says the ark, it seems to suggest the ark was there for 20 years. The ark had been there for at least 67 years. The 20 years there, I think, is a reference to the time from when the ark actually came to Kirjath-Jearim to Samuel's reform, which is what the chapter is talking about. It was a long, long time before that reform came, and that was the 20 years that it's spoken of. But the ark had actually been there for 67 and a half years at least, because it was there for those 20 years, another 40 of Saul's reign, and another 7 and a half of David's reign. So it's at least 67 and a half years. That's quite amazing. And all that time, no one had even bothered about it. So David's determined to bring this up, and he's got the groundswell of the people behind him. So verse 6 says that David went up and all Israel to Baala, that is to Kirjath-Jearim. It was another name, which is quite fascinating. Here's the ark of God in this town of Kirjath-Jearim in the house of Abinadab. And the name of the town has become known by the name of a false god, by the name of Baal. Anyway, it's this town belonged to Judah, and they're going to bring up from thence the ark of God, Yahweh, that dwelleth between the cherubims, whose name is called on it. You know, that little phrase at the end of that verse really does highlight what David saw in the ark. He just didn't see it as a box like Hophni and Phinehas thought. This was a thing you took out to battle, which they should never have done. They just, you know, somehow it had magical powers. It was just absolute rubbish. David never saw it like that. What he saw when he contemplated the ark, brothers and sisters, was Yahweh that dwelled between the cherubims, whose name is put on that. So he saw this as representative of the throne. See, that dwelleth between the cherubims. The word dwelleth is enthroned. So here God was enthroned in the ark. And that's how David saw it. David saw Yahweh as the king. And he wanted to bring that ark back into the nation. And he wanted all Israel to understand that he was not the king. That in fact the king was here, enthroned above the cherubim. And so they made preparation. Lots of preparation happened on this day. They had all sorts of sacrifices organized and ready. David had made many plans on that day in terms of what he was going to do, what he was going to wear, how it was going to work. He'd even written a psalm. And verse 7 says, and they carried the ark of God in a new cart out of the house of Abinadab. And Uzzah and Ahio, who were the sons, by the way, of Abinadab, and living in the house of Abinadab, they drave the cart. Well, the fact that it was a new cart probably means there was some thought went into this. But we all know that they were not supposed to put it on a cart. And they should have all known that they weren't supposed to put it on a cart. But remember that ark hadn't been moved at least for 70 years. And before that, for hundreds of years. So no one had actually seen it like they had in the wilderness, constantly being moved. And there was a reminder. And even the Levites and the priests had evidently not been used to dealing with it because they hadn't moved it. And so it goes onto a cart. It's a sad thing, isn't it, brothers and sisters, because that's exactly how the Philistines had sent it back, on a new cart. And in the preparation that happened here, and I think David had actually left this preparation to those who were there living in Kirjath-Jearim, I think there's some hints at least in the record that is the case. In David's enthusiasm, he had actually overlooked this as well. He hadn't micromanaged all of the things to do with it. And yes, not even David actually perceived how serious that might have actually been. But I think Uzzah and Ahio, I don't know what you think about Uzzah and Ahio, but I was a little surprised when I sort of having a bit more closer look at this, because it says they came out of Gibeah, it just means on the hill in Kirjath-Jearim. And it says that Ahio went before the ark and presumably Uzzah came in behind the ark and they were driving it on a cart. But you know that cart had come into Abinadab's house nearly 70 years before this day. And at that time his son Eliezer was sanctified and took care of it. Now, we don't read of Eliezer here. We only read of these two. So it's quite possible that Eliezer's actually dead. But what it does mean is that probably Uzzah and Ahio were not young men like most of the pictures you see. They were probably quite old men. And because, you know, if their brother was there 67 years before and he was grown up and able to be sanctified to look after the ark 67 years before, well, even if these are the young kid brothers of Eliezer, then they're still old people. They're still old men. And so what we find is that it's all going fine. Verse 8, and David and all Israel played before Yahweh. Rotherham and RSV says, and David and all Israel were dancing for joy before Yahweh with all boldness or with all their might. and with singing and harps and psalteries and timbrels and cymbals and trumpets. And David had organised all of this beforehand. And it's an amazing experience that had caught all the people up in this exultant time where they were so delighted to see that Yahweh was actually coming back into the midst of the nation. And all these musicians had been pre-organised and planned. And, you know, just see the spirit of this man here. Just because God is coming near, just because God is coming to where he is, he's so delighted, you know. I just sort of stand in awe of this man at times, brothers and sisters. Is that our spirit? We have that same sort of desire for God to come into our lives, to be right alongside us. You know, David wrote Psalm 16 and he said, putting words into Messiah's mouth later, he said, I have set Yahweh always before me. Therefore, my heart is glad and my soul rejoices. Is that our spirit, brothers and sisters? Or are we glad sometimes to just get away from God? Or to have some rooms in our house that we just don't want God to go in? Well, David was never like that. He was a man who had this such an amazing spirit that he just wanted God so close. He always wanted God where he was. He brought him there. And now the nation has been infected by that same spirit. And right then, in the midst of that euphoria, verse 9, and they came to the threshing floor of Kidon. Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled, and the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Uzzah and smote him because he put his hand to the ark, and there he died. Can you imagine? Can you just imagine what that must have been like? In the midst of that incredible scene, suddenly, the whole thing is struck down. Dead silent. All the instruments stop. Everyone's in shock. And Yahweh kills Uzzah. It says it. He was angry at Uzzah and killed him. Well, there's not that many places where God directly intervenes and kills individuals. And Uzzah was singled out. Because Uzzah should have known better. The ark had been in his house for 67 and a half years. And the only reason it was in his father's house was because the men of Beth Shemesh had treated it lightly and God had slain 50,000 of them and they pleaded with the men of Kirjath-Jearim to come and get it. So they went and got it and they put it in his house. So there was the history that he must have known about. But now he too had become too familiar with holy things. You know, I had said, I'll be sanctified in them that draw nigh me. We don't know whether Uzzah was a Levite or not. The record doesn't actually tell us. I have a hunch from chapter 15 and verse 2, that he wasn't. But I can't prove it. Chapter 15, verse 2 says, and then David said, none ought to carry the ark but the Levites. For them hath Yahweh chosen to carry the ark of God and minister unto him forever. It was in the territory of Judah, and it may well have actually been that he was not even a Levite. He possibly was, but he may not have been. And Yahweh struck him because he had presumptuously been involved in this organisation of this whole event, putting it on a cart and now touching the ark. You know, it wasn't, brothers and sisters, just a little technical fault that he made and God was so wrathful that he was just going to fix up some little thing and wreck this amazing spirit of this party. We find in the next verse, verse 11, that David was displeased. You know, that's exactly the same word as anger in verse 10. David was angry. The authorized versions actually tried to cover that up, but David was angry. As you can probably imagine, he didn't understand what in the middle of all this, what's going on. Everything, all the indicators seemed to be going in the right direction. And he called the place the breach on Uzzah. But then verse 12 tells us David was afraid of God that day. It turned to fear. And look at the spirit of the man in the end of verse 12. He says, "How shall I bring the ark of God home to me?" You see, this longing, brothers and sisters, for him to be where God is, despite the fact that there's this tremendous embarrassment and breach made in the middle of this whole thing. And he didn't understand exactly at the time. It's being out of harmony with God that he found his greatest grief. And he feared that day. But verse 13 tells us that David brought not the ark home to himself as he wanted to the city of David. But he carried it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. You know, he carried it aside. The word carried aside means to stretch or to bend away. It's actually a word that's used of Balaam's ass. Balaam's ass moved away because he could see the angel in front of him. And he moved out around. It means, in a sense, to get out of one's way or to go out of one's way. So David chose, and notice it tells us David did it. They didn't. Up until now, it's they did this, they. Now it's David himself taking control. David brought not the ark home, but he carried it aside into the house of Obed-Edom. He decided it was going to go into the house of Obed-Edom. Why the house of Obed-Edom? Wherever that was, whether it was close or not, he took it to the house of Obed-Edom. Well, we haven't got time to turn this up. But in 1 Chronicles 26 and verse 1 and 4, it's worth putting that in your margin. 1 Chronicles 26 verses 1 and 4, we find that Obed-Edom and his sons were Kohathites. And the sons of Kohath were those, they were from a it says they were Gittites here, but they were from a town called Gath-Rimmon, which is further up north, and that was a Kohath town, a town where the Kohathites actually lived. So he took it into the house of the of this man Obed-Edom. Whether he had another house closer than that, but if it was to the house of his house in Gath-Rimmon, it's actually a little way for him to go. But we know this, that from Numbers chapter 4, which we don't have time to turn to now, Numbers chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, and also from chapter 7, Numbers chapter 7, verse 9, that the Kohathites were those who were designated to carry the ark, and they had to carry the ark on shoulders. You know, it's really interesting in Numbers chapter 7, because it tells us that what Numbers 7 is about is saying, now, you've got all this stuff to carry for the ark in the wilderness, for the temple and tabernacle in the wilderness, and to the other components of the Levites were given so many wagons, so many carts to carry all their stuff. But it says explicitly that to the sons of Kohath, they were given none because they had to carry it on their shoulders. You see, why was this really so important? Why was the issue of the ark going not on a cart but on shoulders so important? Well, this was not a minor technicality of the law. You know, we know on that day there were lots of things that happened that were not according strictly to the law. But this was not just a minor technicality. This was an absolutely major principle that was overlooked by Uzzah and Ahio, the Levites, the priests, and even David, who'd put it in their hands. Because the ark represented the presence of God, and there was his character manifested, and he was going to reign supreme there between the cherubim. He was to be lifted up on their shoulders as king. He was to be borne by men. You know, in the scriptures, brothers and sisters, the shoulder is put for a symbol of service. It's put for a symbol of responsibility, particularly in service. So Isaiah 9 verse 6 says, "The government shall be upon his shoulder," speaking of Christ in the age to come. We find of Israel pulling away the shoulder in Zechariah 7 and other places. So the glory of God, which is his character, which is seen there, represented in the ark between the cherubims, can only ever be carried by net and never by a cart. You can't actually associate the glory of God's character with inanimate things. It had to be connected to men and women. And it can't be palmed off. You can't take it off your shoulder because you're tired and put it on a cart and just make it easy. It was not meant to be easy. There was a really significant principle here, because God intended that the development of his character, the bearing of his glory, was to be an effort, was to have respect and humility and courage and strength associated with it. It needed to be part of those who were carrying it. It was a personal connection. You know, Uzzah's name means strength. So even in his name, he had the strength to do it. But he's lazy and put on a cart and given up his responsibility. He's put his service to someone else. But we can never do that, brothers and sisters. And the principle was so important that God made a breach that day. And Uzzah died. You know, we need to go away tonight, brothers and sisters, and just think about where the glory of God is in our lives. Whether it's whether we've got the ark on our shoulder or on a cart. And if we've got it on our shoulder, we'll feel the weighty responsibility of that, and it will affect us. Well, David realized the tragedy was as a result of some significant breach here. And I think the very fact that David immediately sent the ark to the house of Obed-Edom indicates that he had already worked out that this is probably something to do with it, but he didn't know whether that was all. And we find that in chapter 15, at verse 2, that he tells us that none ought to carry the ark but the Levites. So he'd worked that out. And verse 12, when they take their second attempt, and he said unto them, "Yea, the chief of the fathers of the Levites, sanctify yourselves that you may bring up the ark. For because, verse 13, you did it not at the first, for Yahweh our God made a breach on us, for that we sought him not after the due order. So the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark, and the children of the Levites bear the ark of God upon their shoulders with the staves thereon, as Moses commanded according to the word of Yahweh." This was not just a little technical thing. They did it not at first. They had not had seen the significance of this principle. And even David had overlooked it. And David accepted responsibility for that. Did you notice there? He said, "Ye did it not at first," certainly in verse 13, "but Yahweh made a breach on us because we sought him not after the due order." It wasn't just about Uzzah touching something that he wasn't meant to touch. He almost certainly had carried it onto the cart in the first place and hadn't been struck dead. But in the midst of all of that, God was going to make a point. Now, I've got a very grave decision to make as to what we do from here. Time's gone. I think what we might do is go to Psalm 132, and we'll finish there. I'll tell you what I'm planning to do, God willing, next class anyway, is to pick up this theme, particularly of the tabernacle of David, the tent that David took it to, and just have a look at the significance. So we are going to come back to this, and there are a number of psalms, quite a large number of psalms, that David that are attributed to this particular era, and certainly Psalm 132 is one of those. And it's we find verse 1, "Yahweh, remember David in all his afflictions," and certainly this was a period of affliction. Psalm 30, that unfortunately we don't have really time to go to tonight, is another that's set in this period and sort of indicates that David was actually quite sick at this period and Yahweh healed him. Whether it was a result of Yahweh bringing a consequence upon him, or whether David was just so overwrought by the whole set of circumstances that he himself almost went down to the grave? We don't know. But we do know that in the context, David saw it as the hand of Yahweh healing him. He saw Yahweh's anger, and he didn't like being out of favour, and he longed for the time when he could be back in favour with God again. So David's very troubled here. Lord, remember David in all his afflictions, how he swore unto Yahweh and vowed unto the mighty God of Jacob, surely I will not come into the tabernacle of my house, nor go up to my bed, till I will not give sleep to mine eyes nor slumber to mine eyelids until I find out a place for Yahweh and habitation of the mighty God of Jacob. You know, really the context of this psalm is, I think, more particularly set in this period, this period between the first and second attempt to bring the ark to Zion. Because he desperately wanted to find out a habitation for Yahweh. He wanted to know what God really thought. He wanted God to come up into the midst of the nation. And he says, verse 8, "Arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest, thou in the ark of thy strength. Let thy priests be clothed with righteousness, and let the saints shout for joy." This was his desire above all things, and he must have prayed and prayed and prayed and wept tears and meditated day and night through that whole period, brothers and sisters. And God answers. God answers him. His anxieties are relieved. Verse 13, "For Yahweh has chosen Zion." He has desired it. You're right, David. You're actually on the right track. There was one problem in the midst of all that, but David, I am actually pleased with where you're going. Verse 14, "This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell, for here have I desired it." And David must have been stimulated to actually receive that confirmation that he was actually on the right track. Verse 16, "I will clothe also her priests with salvation, and her saints shall shout aloud for joy, and there will I make the horn of David to bud. I have ordained a lamp for mine anointed, for my king. His enemies will I clothe with shame, but upon him shall a crown flourish." And David returned. He saw God bless the house of Obed-Edom. God interpreted that as a signal. And he gathered all Israel again. And this time they brought up the ark amidst great shouting and joy. And we'll take it up from there and see what David actually did following the arrival of the ark into Jerusalem in the next class.